Hello, and welcome to Movies We Dig, the podcast about film, antiquity, and everything in between. I'm Colin McCormick.
I'm Elijah Fleming.
And I'm Christy Vogler.
And today we are back with another installment of our special mini-series, Extremely Strained and Incredibly Forced, where guests come to pitch us, the reception police, what they think is a connection between something ancient and something modern. Today we are joined back again by Alexandra Sills from the University of Leicester, who is going to talk to us about the recent Hunger Games film, The Battle of Songbirds and Snakes. Welcome back, Alexandra.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Of course. So we've already been talking a little bit about this, but we're going to sort of rehash over the points we were discussing. But if you could just tell us really quick, introduce, do you, one, dig the Hunger Games in this particular installment, and talk to us a little about where you think there is some connection between what's going on in the film and what was going on in our pasts.
So my initial reaction to the film was that I'm not sure it needed to exist at all. That said, I mean, I did enjoy the movie, and I do think it has some interesting classical reception. There's some parallels in there that certainly got me thinking as someone who looks at spectacle a lot.
Yeah. Eli, Christy, what about you two?
So I am a longtime fan of Susan Collins. I read a lot of dystopian books back in the 2010s and saw these movies.
It's the thing to do in the early 2010s.
I know. And now it's like, I did not want to watch this movie because it's like some of it is hitting really close to home in a lot of places. And I didn't mention this last time, but like a course that I used to teach was History 103, Turning Points in History. And I focused on major mass killing events. And I had major links between the Trojan War, the Spanish conquest, and the Rwandan genocide in 1994. And I saw so much of classical reception, but also a lot of things I saw in, like, you can go back and see footage of the genocide in 94. And like some of the language is just so eerily similar that this is hard to watch sometimes. And I am happy to say I did not enjoy watching a bunch of children kill each other. I think the part I really did like is I got a sense of a kind of Greek mythology storyline focused just on, I forgot her name again.
Lucy Gray
and Choreo. That to me was it was kind of a weird reverse Orpheus and Eurydice, where like Eurydice is the singer this time, and you know she's able to quell the snakes with her singing. You know that's not true. And Choreo has to like travel to the underworld, aka the districts, and has to choose between like returning back to the above world and or just staying in the underworld with her. And she makes it sound really damn appealing. And I saw that as a very similar to Achilles' choice of like, I can stay here in Troy and die young with glory to my name, or I can just go home and enjoy life and die a nameless old man. So I saw a lot of kind of underworld stories happening in this as well. Mm-hmm. So I liked that part a lot. I thought that was a really cool adaptation of the Orpheus story. So yeah, that's the part I liked. I get a little disheartened by the whole Hunger Games part of it, though. And that's, yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. I am also a big Hunger Games fan. I really enjoyed the books as a younger person. And I thought they did like a decent job with the movies in terms of like books to movies. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there are some really bad examples, but these I feel like were decent. And I think I enjoyed watching this movie because I enjoyed being back in that world. But I think I agree very much with Alexandra that this story didn't really need to be told. This is not the villain origin story that I need or want, because I have no way of rooting for this anti-hero who just keeps making the worst choices and is a complete descent into like darkness, I guess.
But he's hot.
However, yes. I know, but he's hot, so it's fine.
Handsome murder man, is what we call him.
If bad, why hot?
If bad, why hot? But I do really enjoy this as a reception piece because I think the central theme of this is like a struggle for power. And I think we can draw a lot of ties and connections with our ancient history and making really, really bad choices in an attempt to gather power.
Yeah. So one of the things that this movie, just as some context for listeners, one, that although we do this sometimes, we are not this time making up any sort of classical connection, because the author, Susan Collins, has been very upfront that the story was not only inspired by Greek mythology, particularly Theseus getting sent into the labyrinth with a bunch of other Athenian tributes to be sacrificed to the Minotaur, but also the history of gladiator games and spectacles in ancient Rome and the way those developed. And there's lots of sort of allusions here and there. The names are kind of the most obvious thing, like lots of characters are named after Roman figures. The country itself, Panem, comes from this poem, a satirist in Rome who said that Panem et Circenses. So bread and circuses are kind of what keeps the ball rolling in ancient Rome. But one of the things that this movie is really about, we were just talking about, is the kind of how Snow, our anti-hero, if you want to call him that, sort of reinvents the games and takes them from this kind of dilapidated, petering out state around the 10th Hunger Games, and then really revitalizes them, turns them into the mega spectacles that we're going to see in the original trilogy with Katniss and PETA and so forth. And so, Alexandra, if you could talk to us a little bit about, I know you have some thoughts about this idea of the kind of evolution of games and spectacles in the early stages of nation building.
Yeah. And I think for me, it's the interesting part is where they kind of run along parallel lines to start off with, but then the divergence is really the definition of difference between ancient and modern. But I think they start off with the same kind of thing, which is a trauma response on, you know, society level to something so horrific, something so terrible that's happened in their society that they've underestimated the scale of, and now they're sat back and thinking, oh my God, what do we do now? And when I was watching it, the first thing I thought of was the escalation in spectacle in Rome following the Battle of Cannae, which was in 216 BCE. And that battle, I mean, Donald G. Kyle calls it the crystallization of military virtue in Rome. And I love that quote because it does kind of tell you everything you need to know about how much of a game changer this huge defeat was. Sorry, spoiler alert, they lost that battle. And how they deal with losing that massive battle. So for some context, the Battle of Cannae is against Hannibal and the Carthaginians, and it was the largest army that the Romans had fielded up to that point. I think it was about 85,000 Romans. And just to clarify, these aren't the trained soldiers that we kind of think of when we think Roman army and, you know, the military machine. They're not that. They're farmers and laborers that have just, you know, for the military season, been handed some weapons and told, you know, off you go. And despite this, they're feeling quite confident because they outnumber the Carthaginians quite drastically. They're feeling kind of good, but they've forgotten that the Carthaginian army and their allies are all trained professional soldiers. So really, who's truly outnumbered? And it turns into a complete bloodbath. And it's, you know, we don't have an eyewitness account, but we have Polybius, who apparently spoke to people on both sides who'd fought there. And Livy was also using some other sources from the time. And what they both say is that this was a kind of nightmare scenario of true horror for the Romans that got stuck there, being kind of mowed down. And even though we need to take some of these stories with a bit of a pinch of salt, I think, the kind of rumours that get back to Rome of there were Romans on the battlefield who were, instead of waiting to get annihilated, they tried to suffocate themselves by digging a hole and burying their head in the ground so that they'd be dead by the time the Carthaginian blades met them, and that kind of thing. And within a day, we think it's about 20% of the males of military age were just gone, you know, wiped out. And with them, a lot of the government. So as well as a huge proportion of the population, you've also got a lot of the ruling class that are just gone within, you know, a snap of the fingers. And it's the response from Rome that's really kind of chilling. I think it's Cicero says that it was the Republic Senate's finest hour, the way they responded to this. And I guess reading it, I don't know whether I agree, because their response was, ah, okay, we've lost a huge proportion of the army. What do we do with the survivors? There weren't many survivors, by the way. The few that managed to escape are told, don't bother coming home. You're in exile now. Go and live on Sicily. We don't want you. And Hannibal, we're told, had taken about 10,000 hostages who hadn't been on the battlefield. Their job had been to look after the supplies. They all get rounded up, and Hannibal sends 10 of them to Rome to say, okay, what are you going to pay us for ransom? And the Senate turns around and says, no, we're not paying a ransom. We don't want them. If they're survivors, that means that they must be cowards, right? So we don't want them. They're not Roman anymore. We wash our hands of this. You can do what you want. And they actually, as well as not taking the survivors back, and bearing in mind, you know, their colleagues are amongst those numbers. They don't know who survived. They might be condemning a consul or their fellow senators, their sons. They don't care. They've washed their hands of these people. And Plutarch and Appian pick up on it and what happened to these hostages. Most of them were slaughtered, and then a lot of them were also enslaved and sold. And there's talk about 20 years later, you're still finding some of the survivors from Cannae enslaved in Greece, 20 years later. So the Senate has said, we don't want these men. They're not Roman enough for us. Kill them if you want. But when you think about how many people that is, 85,000 people aren't coming home. That's going to have a knock-on effect on every single level of Roman society. Think about it in terms of families. There's going to be every family affected at some level. Every street is going to be mourning someone. And for the people left in Rome, especially since the Senate has banned anyone from raising funds to pay the ransom themselves, so they've been explicitly told it is illegal to try and save your own kin. Don't do it. So you've got these people in the city and they're thinking, this terrible thing has happened to us. What the hell are we going to do about it? And of course, one response is, we're going to turn ourselves from citizen soldiers into the most terrifying army that the ancient world's ever seen, right? But back at home, they process it in a completely different way. And what I think is interesting when a society goes through a traumatic event like that is, does it make them more merciful and empathetic, or does it kind of harden them and make them a bit more cruel? And what we see happening here is they went, straight for the cruel. They wanted scapegoats, so they decided that this whole disaster would never have happened if the Vestal Virgins had kept their legs together. So they buried one of the Vestals alive. They accused another one, but she killed herself before she could be buried alive. And one of their accused lovers was beaten to death. That wasn't enough. They also decided to bury some enslaved people alive. There was a man and a woman from Greece and a man and a woman from Gaul. They were all buried alive. And they go straight to, we need to start killing people to process what we've been through. And it's at the same time, this is when we kind of see an escalation in gladiatorial combat. The first gladiators in Rome were about half a century before Cannae. It's a couple of gladiators fighting in, it's a funeral rite. So you get a couple of them at notable funerals. But then 50 years later, we suddenly see this step up a gear. So the same year as Cannae, a couple of months after Cannae, there was a funeral for Marcus Aemilius Lepidus, and he had nearly 50 gladiators at his, which is a huge step up. And then a couple of decades after that, you've got 120 gladiators at a funeral. And then a couple of decades after that, you've got a funeral games that now lasts 3 days. And then a couple of years after that, so about 50 years after Cannae, you've got a foreign king, Antiochus III over in Antioch in what's now Turkey, saying, okay, he was a Roman hostage, so he knew he'd seen gladiators and he had decided to import them back to his homeland. And he'd been buying them for 10 years. And he's saying, no, your costs are too high. So within 50 years of this traumatic event, gladiators are now something that are being exported to places beyond the empire at that point at exorbitant prices. And it's kind of where we see the change from just being something that you see at funerals to something that has this extra layer of ideology kind of grafted onto it of, okay, at Cannae, we weren't manly enough, we weren't strong enough, we didn't fight well enough, and we certainly didn't die in a courageous way, burying our heads literally in the ground. So we need to teach ourselves how to do that. How do we do that? We watch the gladiators who are going to teach us how to be strong and manly and military and how to die without flinching. Teach us kind of how to be not just strong, but kind of that keep that cool head. So I think with the Hunger Games, they've gone through the first rebellion of the districts and they've underestimated again how that rebellion would go. I don't think anyone in the capital would have said this rebellion is going to last for 3 years and we're going to end up resorting to cannibalism, you know, before it's over. So they've got this huge trauma response. We see Corio Snow's family has been reduced to absolute poverty. And again, their trauma response isn't to go merciful and empathetic. It's to go straight to hardening their hearts and thinking, okay, who can we start killing? And in their case, they've instead of prisoners of war and enslaved people, they've chosen children because, you know, why not?
Yeah. And so that's the connection I actually see to a lot of the literature referring to the Trojan War. So Euripides' Trojan Women is specifically where we get the story of Astyanax being thrown off the wall under Odysseus's orders, with the reasoning being only a fool kills the father and allows the son to live. And that's kind of what I would teach in this class, is this idea of, like, you know, how do mass killing events take place? How does genocide take place? It really doesn't start so much from a place of hate. What it really starts is from a place of fear that if I don't do this to you, someday you'll do it to me.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this framing we hear a few times within the movie itself where it's like, the things we do to survive, right? And it's like, mm-hmm. this is what humans really are, as opposed to it's like, well, this is what the world does to humans. And I think it's really interesting because we get a very, we see the difference between how people can react to that trauma. Like, one is a sort of denial, saying like, I didn't really do anything bad. I was just trying to survive. And that was the really heartbreaking line of the one girl who's like, I can't have killed them all for nothing.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And there's this line between Corio and Lacey Gray.
Why? Lucy Gray.
Lucy Gray. I wanted to be Lacey so bad. Here it is.
You are not a killer, Lucy Gray.
Yes, I am. Both of us are now.
And I like that because, like, that's the difference, right? Lucy Gray recognizes she is a killer. She understands why she had to kill, but she's not trying to sanitize what that makes her. And Corio continuously does that, right? Like, he's just saying, it's like, I just had to, like, that's what I had to do to survive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting because I think if after we look at mass killing events, and this is why I draw it back to, for me, I draw it back to the Rwandan genocide, is like, you know, what can the reaction be? Can it be like, they did this to us, so we're going to return the favor and make sure it never happens to us again? And that's why Rwanda is a really interesting case study, because they supposedly have gone through this process of reconciliation between the two sides. And this was something that was also talked about in the movie. It's like, I think Sejana says, like, you know, some of these kids were thrown into the arena. You know, the oldest were 8 when the war ended, and some of the youngest were only 2. And you'll hear that now, like, there are Hutu who fled Rwanda, and the children of those Hutu that were the perpetrators, they're being raised and told that, like, oh, if you go back to Rwanda, like, the Tutsis hate us for, like, what happened, and they're, you know, they're going to kill you on the spot. And the government is trying to say, it's like, no, you were children, you weren't even born, like, we don't blame you for what happened. And I think it's really interesting to see how you can have two possible different reactions to that. The one additional note I would say is, like, that theme of blaming the child for something committed by the father. If we think about this, Snow wouldn't have bothered with the Hunger Games if Highbottom, the dean, hadn't been bitter and refused to give him the money to go to college. Had he just been given the Plinth Award, Snow would have given zero f- about this whole Hunger Games thing. And, like, it might have just died, right? Like, Highbottom in trying to kill the Hunger Games but holding this grudge against Corio and his father is what ends up perpetuating and escalating them. So, like, that theme is really present.
The irony that Tigress kind of says at the end is that Coriolanus has become his father, where his father, I believe, is an arms dealer and sort of made their money on the war and then was killed in the war. And then Coriolanus has sort of, that's his arc, such as it is that he turns into this guy who perpetuates violence and profits off it.
And I think it was interesting to see Highbottom was the one that thought up the games as something so horrific that it would kind of thought of it as a joke. And to deal with the fact that it's become a reality, he's become a drug addict. Mm-hmm. And I thought, you know, it's impossible for us, apparently, to make films about war without bringing it to the 20th century wars, right?
Sure.
And there are, you know, so many examples in this movie. But one that sprung to mind, especially after cinema this summer, was that they kind of gave Highbottom at the end the kind of Oppenheimer regret speech. Just before, you know, he's murdered by Snow.
So this is the question I wanted to kind of pose, which is a thing that I think this franchise, not uniquely, but it does kind of particularly struggle with, which is I think constantly about films that are about war and violence, or in this case, child gladiators. There's this quote from Francois Truffaut who says something that's like to the effect of like all war films end up being pro-war. Right. Yeah. Where like a Hunger Games, and the irony is like the whole point of the Hunger Games franchise is I would argue it's an anti-war or an anti-trauma or an anti-violence series. But the movies into sort of ironically, they become like a metaphor for themselves. For to sell the Hunger Games, we need to spectacularize the Hunger Games. So we need very dynamic action and violence and fight scenes. And I wanted to poll the three of you on what you sort of thought about the way like the themes of violence in this series versus the depiction of violence in the text being film.
So obviously I'm thinking of it from a gladiatorial perspective. And one of the things I noted with this film is that it does seem to be more so than the other films in the trilogy, more kind of haphazard. So by the time of the trilogy, if you think about it compared to Rome, the trilogy is when the Colosseum's been built and it's the heyday of gladiatorial combat, right? And this is back when it's all a bit more makeshift and a little bit loosey-goosey. And you don't have career tributes yet who are training specifically for this. You don't have the training before the game starts so that they can rank the tributes. So the violence, it seems more, a lot of this is because CGI in the last 10, 15 years has, you know, already come on leaps and bounds. But a lot of it seems to be a little bit more visceral almost because there's more of a sense, even more than the trilogy, that this is really makeshift. And it literally is children trying to kill each other in horrific ways. And what I thought was interesting on this one was the violence of execution. They make it very clear, don't they, that the games aren't just an execution. It is a spectacle. And then when one of the tributes, I think it's the tribute from two, Marcus, so the arena before the games, the arena is bombed by rebels. So hopefully they can't use it.
Question mark.
Yeah, question marks, exactly. And it turns out, no, it's not going to stop the games at all. They're just going to turn it into something they can use. Make the arena a bit more exciting than it has been for the last 10 years. And during the bombing, some of them try to get away. And I think this is during the bombing or whether he gets away somewhere else. But Marcus tries to run and he is caught. And instead of, you know, just a bullet in the back of the head like they do with some of the others, they decide to make an example of him and they crucify him in the middle of the arena. And I thought that that was more cruel, possibly, than any of the things that I'd seen in the original trilogy, because it was just a straight up execution rather than trying to turn it into something else. And it's partly there so that they can show that the tributes have more mercy than the Capitol still, because one of them kills him with an axe as a mercy killing. Mm-hmm. But it to me, it was more of a, okay, we're killing you. And they didn't care as much. It was so blatant. At least with the trilogy, they kind of dressed it up a bit as we're training them to win, but this is really just, no, we're killing
well,
them.
Well, and doesn't Flickerman bring us, like, he's trying to make the Pan Am audience question if it was a mercy killing, right? Like, because that's part of the question too. At this point, the purpose of the games is to me, it feels like to assuage the anger of Panem, of the capital, at what has happened to them. And the reason you're losing interest in the games as is like, you kind of realize just having a bunch of children slaughtered in an open arena doesn't really change what happened in the past. No. So like, you just don't care. Like, you realize it's like, they had nothing to do with it. It's not really doing anything, but the goal of, the game maker is to make you continue to feel threatened of like, look what they do to each other. Mm-hmm. If they were set loose on us, this is what they would do to us. And so Flickerman has that. It's like, oh, we can see that being a mercy killing. He's quickly rewriting that to like make us question. It's like, or is it just an easy kill for her?
Mm-hmm. Right. And this is kind of Viola Davis's sort of thesis. She's playing Volumnia Gall, the first game master. And she's like, what's the point of the games? And then the initial response is that it's to punish the districts and display our might and them know that we will not suffer sedition. And then by the end, it becomes this thesis about human nature and that humans are inherently violent and need to be controlled. In the games, what they do is that they strip away the civility and the niceness of society and then show people that they're really bloodthirsty, desperate, violent beings who will kill one another to ensure their own survival. And, that's the Snow's kind of shortcoming is he embraces that pessimistic reading and sort of comes to see the games as this necessary evil.
That kind of brings us back to the conversation we had before, and like what Snow initially proposes is like, if no one's caring about the games for the wholesale slaughter, like if it's not assuaging anger, if it's not really creating fear, because again, it's just a bunch of children who aren't trained killing each other in an open arena. Like, that's not scary. It's heartbreaking.
Yeah.
It's like, so he shifts. It's like, we actually need to make people care about these fighters. We need to, like he literally says, we need to humanize them, which is so kind of opposite of thinking when you're talking about mass killing events. Is like, usually the goal is to dehumanize someone. Even the spectacle is like, they're criminals, they're animal, like there's sometimes literal animal hunts and everything, right? Mm-hmm. So you're not meant to feel bad for those who actually die in the arena, with the weird exception being the gladiators, who don't die in the arena as often as we used to believe.
Yeah. And this is where I think the divergence happens between the ancient and the modern, right? Because the Romans had to other the gladiators to stomach being able to watch them. We've got that nice scene with Sejanus Plinth saying, well, how are we expecting these people to watch these children killing each other? The Roman solution was to recruit them primarily from prisoners of war and enslaved people, so people that you don't care about already. And then adding on that level of the social stigma of infamia. So you might admire a gladiator and you're certainly looking to them to, teach you how to be a man, but you're never going to want to be seen dead talking to them in the forum or inviting them over for dinner. So that's how the Romans did it. They gave them stage names and put helmets on them so you can't see their face. They strip them of everything that kind of identifies them as an individual.
And like typologize them, where they become like, absolutely, the kind of gladiator you are is like, you're sort of regional. You're like the
Thracian.
Yeah. The arch fight literally was a trident and a net when the one girl, I was like, I so picked up on that.
Yeah, they're actually from District 4, the fishermen. It makes, it makes perfect sense when you think about it. And it also proves that the retiarius was actually a lot stronger than the Romans gave them credit for. But this is kind of, I think, with our modern obsession with celebrity culture and reality television and, everyone having that sob story narrative when they go on these shows and that kind of thing. That's where we see this divergence kind of seeping through into fiction, is that instead of dehumanizing these tributes even more than they already are, because, they're from the districts, instead Corio's solution is to anti-infamia them and kind of rehumanize them and give them personalities and personas almost, and to kind of provoke these parasocial relationships with them instead of stripping away their individuality. Yeah. He's kind of pushing them to be more individualized. And that's, I think, you wouldn't get that without our background of reality TV and mm-hmm. everyone getting their 15 minutes and
mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, but in the 10th games, they're kept in a zoo. They're literally kept in a zoo and berated yeah. and starved. And then by the time you get to Katniss, she has a whole PR team. You have days right. of training and press tours and makeup and costuming and creating sort of narratives around it to, you know, promote followers effectively,
yeah.
which means donations, which means
I think that's an important point. You need the money incentive.
Like, this is what I was going to say. Yes, Christy, it's the monetization of it all. And I think yeah. that really goes back into how we might see this violence is just, you know, pure, awful, terrible kids killing each other. But what if you could bet on it? What if you mm-hmm. could like donate money and send them water? What if you could help them? What if you could interact, you know, mm-hmm. by
and you could be the one something? To save them through your donations.
Yes. And so we're creating that parasocial relationship, just like you buy something that an influencer is telling you to. It's reaffirming that weird monetized relationship. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is absolutely the key. And that's exactly what Snow does, right? He creates the system to monetize it.
Yeah.
And it's so gross.
And it makes me wonder too, where the Hunger Games, I think, was written in, is it 2009?
2008
when the first book came out. So it was, you know, thinking of reality TV in the late aughts was sort of one way. And then I think really in the last
It's also with this Donald Trump.
It makes me wonder what the Hunger Games would look like if it was written 10 years later, say like that, like after the explosion of like Instagram and you know, not that social media existed in 2008, but not the way it does, like influencers and mm-hmm. publicification of every aspect of people's lives. And, you know, we'd be tracking sort of subscribers or something like that on like all of the tributes' social.
And this huge, you know, provocation of be involved with this person who's never going to consider you, never going to think about you, but be involved with them and think about it. I think
like a podcast. Which leads us to our sponsor. If you want to donate us, you can find Gusto on Ko-fi.
I mean, you become involved in these people's lives. You buy their merchandise and you think, oh, I'm helping this person. I'm supporting. You know, often they're billionaires with butt implants, but let's, you know, forget that bit for a moment. Right. Because you feel like you're supporting someone. You feel like you're being generous. And it's the other side of the ancient coin, isn't it? I mean, the Romans were thinking, they were watching the spectacle and thinking about, yeah, I could do that. But I wouldn't be showing any mercy. So they're kind of testing their mettle, but vicariously from the Colosseum seats. But instead in the Hunger Games, and I guess to a certain extent us, we've changed that. And instead of thinking, I'm not going to show any mercy, I'm going to be awful, I'm going to show generosity. And that's, you know, with the drones coming in, and you want to give people that kind of thought, I suppose, nowadays of, yeah, you're a good person because you're doing this. You're the reason that they're there doing these horrible mm-hmm. things that they're doing, which might involve, you know, whatever it is influencers do. Mm-hmm. Jesus Christ.
Well,
yeah, part of it, it's the commodification of people, where gladiators are very much commodities. Yes. They're owned by other people. And even like every part, not to get into like the theory of biopolitics, but like their bodies are owned, but even parts of their body, like their sweat would be sold as like an aphrodisiac. Yep. Again, not how it started, right? It was originally a funeral game tradition. Mm. And then, you know, fast forward a few centuries and you have people buying their sweat off stalls. Chrissy, I cut you off.
I was thinking back to that moment too, of like the football player who last year heart stopped on the field and like the game stopped. And so a guy got hit so hard, his heart stopped on the field. They had to do CPR. He got carted off.
Oh, wow.
The NFL thought about having them continue playing the game after that, like having
Jesus
the players
Christ.
Play. Yeah. And it became this whole, like, it became a reckoning moment of like, oh yeah, this sport is super violent and we're all really into it. Maybe we should think about it. Nope, whole new season. It's fine. He survived. We donated a bunch of money to his fundraiser. All is well.
Yeah.
And whilst
perpetuating, you know, there was that documentary, wasn't there, about American football players? Must clarify for...
I know. Yeah, sorry.
And about head injuries and the trauma that's taken to the brain and how it turns them all into, you know, kind of psychos who can't control their worst impulses. And we've seen this documentary and we know that it happens. And do we stop football going, no, let's make them as big as possible. Let's send in kids and tell them that they can get a free education if they're willing to trade it for, you know,
concussions.
Irreparable brain damage.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this leads into the part of the dynamics that gets played out in the Hunger Games is the way some districts lean into the games as sources for fame, for reputation, for resources, because they get bonuses when they get incentives like food and money and things like that. So they train up tributes and then, you know, buy into their own disenfranchisement.
And that's something that Corio was bringing in after the 10th games. I think if I remember rightly, it was food packages and, for instance, the Victor's Village all started with the 11th games.
Yep.
So only a year after Lucy Gray. And I think the first victor after that was Mags, who was seen again in Catch and Fire. So, he's absolutely thinking about how can I dress it up nicely? And it's kind of like rolling a shit in glitter, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Well, it's turning retaliation into entertainment, right? Like, because you can only fuel pure resentment for so long. But if you can entertain people.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing was the bombs happened and it's opened up all of these tunnels underneath, which suddenly means that there's a hiding place, right? And I think it's Lucky Flickerman, the end of the evening comes and a lot of them are still alive and they're hiding. And he kind of says, well, this is unusual. Strap in, kids. We're going to be here for a while. And that's when I realized, oh, right. You know, the first 9 games must have lasted like an hour or two, like a football game. And then all of a sudden it turns into this multi-day event.
Right. Yeah. Right. Well, and he also says at one point, it's like, oh, she's in wherever she is in that like tunnel or something.
Events
or
whatever. Events.
Yeah.
Yeah. And he's like, we don't have a camera in there, but we will next year. It's like,
You can see him learning in the way. I mean, he's an interesting character just in a lot of ways of this. What is he? Has he introduced himself? He's like weatherman, amateur magician.
Yeah, he's a weatherman.
I love they're doing the weather while people are dying. I mean,
that's part of the general, like we talked already about the desensitization. Did I say that right? Desensitizing to violence. And the way that he's the best example of that, because like when one of the mentors vomits, like he calls that out as violent and crude and uncalled for. Meanwhile, while there's people being murdered and screaming behind
him. What the hell did Flickerman go through during the war that he's just like, hey, y'all, strap in. You got to keep it together.
Well, even the weather itself, he's very casually, I think, mentioning like there's very extreme weather things happening
describing.
He's far too blasé. You just know that he was barbecuing his dead neighbor during, you know, cannibal mean? No.
Yeah.
No. You have the wrong guy.
Mm-hmm. So I know this brings us a little out of like classical reception, but I wanted to talk about the bombing situation because I think I can't quite tell if that was part of Corio's proposal or not. But because Lucy Gray like makes a comment to him, it's like there's nowhere to hide in there. It's like it's just an all-out bloodbath. Mm. And then I think he writes the proposal, and I wonder if like part of the proposal is like, I don't know, make the arena more exciting. And then you have this explosion that takes it out and creates all of these hidey holes. And the question is like, well, you know, we're told it's the rebels who did that. And we're like, what rebel? Like where? And it's very similar to what happened to spark the events of 1994 Rwandan genocide, because the event that sparked that was President Habyarimana's plane being shot down. And to this day, there is no consensus on if it was extremists within his own political party that did that because he was negotiating a peace treaty with Tutsi rebels, or if it's the Tutsi rebels who did it because they wanted to return to Rwanda and have a place in the government. So there's still a huge fight over like who did that. And I think you can see the bombing. It's like, yeah, it's possible that the rebels did it because it is like the major sign of the capital's control over them, right? It is a big monument to that. Yeah. So yeah, it makes sense it would be a target, but it's also super convenient that the president's son dies from his injuries, and that announcement comes to the public right after Reaper does that. Like, that was the most beautiful moment. I thought it was my favorite moment in the film, is he just brings all of the bodies in the center, rips down the Pan Am flag, which is like gut wrenching because it's like they've, you know, all the students have been watching the violence, and then they like stand up aghast at how dare he rip down the Pan Am flag and cover their bodies with it. And he's like, what are you going to do to punish me? And then it cuts out. And we get the news that the president's son died from his injuries from the bombing event. And as a result, we are going to retaliate by just wiping out all the tributes at that point. Because Reaper almost had he had that Katniss moment, right? Or the blue moment of like, oh man, what he just did was badass. And I don't know if what we're doing is right. And this might anger some people.
I have to say, with Reaper, from a Roman perspective, he is the perfect gladiator. Because... I mean, yeah, he gets really angry. And I mean, most gladiatorial stories on screen have a problem with race. And I think it's because they're all too much in the thrall of the 1960s Spartacus, which was, you know, civil rights movements with Jarboe, et cetera, et cetera. And I think Hunger Games is no different from all of the others that came after it, with they've got a bit of a problem with race, angry black guy, that kind of thing. So that's an issue. But his humanity, and particularly his death scene, his death was the perfect gladiatorial death, because you see the others dying from the snakes being thrown in, such as, for instance, Wovey. Oh my God, poor Wovey. And the others, they just go down screaming. And he has the perfect gladiatorial death because he sits there in a calm pose and he waits for it and he takes it without flinching. And that was the epitome of gladiatorial excellence. So... unfortunately for him, he would have been a great gladiator.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Sejanus, because if this were not like an anti-hero story, like he would be our protagonist, right?
Absolutely.
In so many ways, he's the one who has like a conscience, and he's constantly questioning, this is not okay. What are we doing? He has this relationship, like he knows the tribute that he's mentoring, and then breaks into the arena to like do a funeral rite when he dies. And all signs point to like this being our hero, this being the protagonist. What are your guys' Sejanus thoughts, and why isn't he our protagonist?
Can I give you my Greek reception, classical Greek reception? So continuing with the whole traveling to the underworld story, he is Pirithous. And and Choreos Theseus, and they both go to the underworld.
Yeah.
And only one comes back, right?
Well.
And it didn't show this in the movie, and I haven't read the book, but I gleaned from the book that the reason that Choreo records Sejanus and then sends it to Gaul, because it's like, dude, you're going to get him killed. So apparently in the books, it's suggested that Choreo believes that Sejanus's father is so rich that he'll be able to buy Sejanus's way out of that pickle. And I'm just like, what?
He said something to that effect in the movie. Like,
okay,
his father had to buy the school a new auditorium for him to go back to school. And then Choreo says something to the effect of like, your dad can just buy you out of any situation.
Deus Ex Machina kind of
just. But it's like, that would not be my line of reasons. Like, this is like full on treason. You're reporting to the woman who makes horrible monsters to kill people in terrible ways, and yet think it's going to be okay?
I was really, just a little side note, I was really vibing with Viola Davis's whole thing in this, with the the whole like Dr. Frankenstein thing going on. Everything about that character I thought was pretty fun.
Yeah, so that's my pitch. They're the best buds of Greek mythology, and then one is quickly abandoned in the underworld.
My kind of thought is Sejanus is the sacrificial lamb. He's the deal with the devil that Coriolanus makes, right? That's the tipping point of the potential for a Coriolanus to not be evil President Snow. Like, that's when it ends, because once he sort of abandons his best friend to advance his own political career, it's over, basically. I have another thought about Sejanus, but it's a later thing, so I will put a pin in it for now.
Yeah, I mean, and it's very much framed that, like, Sejanus walked himself into a bad situation, right? Like, he gave money to the rebels, believing that they were just going to use it to flee north, but instead they buy armaments that results in all these deaths. that Corio is now tied to. And, you know, if you think about Theseus and Pirithous going to the underworld, well, that was Pirithous's idea because he's like, you know who I want to marry? Persephone. And you're like, poor choice.
What?
Poor
choice. So, yeah, I mean, I think that, like, Sejanus is also makes terrible choices, but he does so out of, like, a very naive wish to make something better.
Well, this comes back to our point about, like, Coriolanus, like, this is how the world works, right?
Yes.
Like, you have to survive, or you survive or you die. And if you survive, that means getting your hands dirty and doing this. And Sejanus is the optimist. So Coriolanus is pessimism.
Yes.
Sejanus believes in the better nature of people, despite evidence to the contrary. And ultimately, it's, you know, it ends up being his fatal flaw that gets him executed for treason. You know, the rebels end up being not as sanitized as Sejanus hopes.
Yeah.
It goes back to those, like, ancient power structures too, right? Like, you either have it through a name, like Snow, or you have it through money. Because very much otherwise Sejanus is very much an outsider.
Yeah, exactly.
He is technically district.
Yes. Yeah.
Who, and his dad has bought his way in, and that he will always be a little, all the money in the world can't overcome deep-rooted social hierarchies.
Yeah. Because the important thing to remember is his family comes from a district.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
So he's not got that kind of deep-rooted.
Patrician.
Yeah, he's absolutely.
Not. Yep.
He's the nouveau.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going back to the idea that it's impossible for us to make any film about war without bringing it back to 20th century. He reminded me a lot. I watched a documentary about the perpetrators of the Holocaust, the Waffen-SS groups that were in charge of, before the camps were kind of running, the massacres in the forest. And it also, that took me to thinking about massacres in, for instance, 5th century Greece, so like Milos, for instance. Thinking about, again, the Trojan women, when that play was put on, members of the audience in that theatre in Athens would have been the people that summer had been on an island killing people.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have to tell yourself to be able to go through with it as a human being? And how much of it is just following instructions and not wanting to be that one person who sticks out as saying, actually, I have doubts about this. And Sejanus just can't put those thoughts aside and dehumanize himself in that way, because it does involve self-dehumanization.
Right.
And it's interesting how easily Corio can. It's like an almost sociopathic level.
Mm-hmm.
And I would, you know, I'd love to speak to those Athenians the same way that this documentary could with some of the SS members in their dotage, you know, talking about, or how could you go through with it, and the kind of the mental gymnastics. Well, if not doing it to them, they would do it to me, or I found it easy because we othered them in this way. And I think it's important that his character isn't capital through and through.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that he can't think that way without, you know, making huge leaps. That short steps for Corio would be a huge leap for Sejanus. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So this leads me to kind of a nittier grittier reception question. But if people have more sort of broader thematic ideas they want to get into, we can do that first. But I wanted to ask, so getting into kind of a real nitty-gritty point of reception, is this, I want, Sejanus is a good segue to talk about the specificity of the references. Because I was wondering if, you know, obviously particularly people in the capital have classical names, Roman patrician names, they're named after historical figures, Coriolanus, Sejanus, there's a Trajan, Volumnia. And I was wondering, to the extent of the choices on the namings, to what extent was it deliberate, or was it just, we're kind of pulling from like a grab bag of names from ancient Rome and we're just kind of going with what sounds cool? Because I thought it was interesting that Coriolanus ends up being the kind of evil dictator, because in Roman history, he's this, there's a Shakespeare play, which I think also maybe coming in and acting as a bit of an intermediary, but he basically like revolts, he joins Rome's enemies and then comes back when his wife and children come back and appeal to his better nature. And then he renounces his hatred on Rome and then joins back, versus Sejanus, who in this movie and book is the kind of most admirable character. He is named after a famous I guess, head of secret police, who tried to basically puppeteering Emperor Trajan. And it's Tiberius, interesting right? to me that.
Yeah, what? Tiberius.
Tiberius.
Yeah. It's interesting to me that the sort of a hero from Roman history, or a sort of hero from Roman history, and the good character is named after one of Roman history's most notorious villains. And I was wondering, to what extent is that like a deliberate inversion, or was it just Suzanne Collins?
I think they've just Googled Roman names that sound cool. You know, this one sounds cool, especially since what I found, they didn't put it in the movie, but he's in love with Lucy Gray, and then he can't be with her because he's, you know, potentially killed her. And in the book, at least, he says in the epilogue, I'm going to marry one of the other students, Fulvia, because she will never touch my heart enough to, you know, sway me from my ideology. Well, that's the Fulvia in The Hunger Games. She's awful, and I'm a bit of an ancient Fulvia stan. So for me, I really hope that wasn't a deliberate choice.
Yeah, maybe it's just like throwing darts at a wall and whatever name hits, like, great. But I feel like there are always going to be things that we can draw out of names. Like, I feel like Sejanus, historically, we could call him a traitor in many ways, right? Mm-hmm. He was sort of, you know, trying to be that puppet master, working behind the scenes, like doing things, behind the emperor's back in a very traitorous way. And he's eventually caught for just that. And Sejanus, even though in the movie, even though we're kind of on his side and he is trying to maybe do the right thing, he is still technically a traitor and enacts treasonous things.
And maybe so I'm reading
maybe I am reading a little bit too hard into it.
Maybe I'm reading too far into this, but also in historically, Sejanus very notably was a plebeian, which is sort of why he sought such underhanded measures to advance his own power, because he was barred by status of birth. I don't know. Again, this may be just like,
I have a theory, because it's like, that's the thing with a lot of these names, right? This is what we learned from watching Domina and I, Claudius, is like, they're recycling a bunch of names. And like, historically, we've decided on like, Tiberius is Tiberius, right? Even though he has like a bunch of other names that we would recognize other emperors also possessing. And what I think Susan Collins has done is instead tied these Greek and Roman names specifically to the capital. And it's not just that. It's tying the idea of Western civilization pantheon of gods to the capital as well. Mm-hmm. Because if you see out in the district, especially in 12, it's like you're out in the nature and everything. But within the capital, in the rebuilding, one of the things you see is a large monumental woman that we would read very much as some kind of goddess, right? And she could personify anything, but she is what overall is personifying is this idea of legitimacy and God being on your side. So to me, it's just a furthering idea of explaining why the capital believes they are in the right in doing everything they are doing. They believe God is on their side, which is something else you see in a lot of mass killing events is not only belief that like you're doing it to save yourself or save people that you care about, but you're right to do so. Like there is a higher power that is allowing you to do that.
I mean, just aesthetically, like the design, and this was definitely deliberate, is that the whole design aesthetic of the Capitol and the way people dress and the buildings is very reminiscent of like fascism, which itself was kind of a neoclassical, like kind of like a sort of stylized, simplified, but very monumental reimagining of ancient architectural styles. So you get that particular, like, I don't know exactly what we would call that style.
Fascist.
Like fascist art, it's basically fascist architecture, which has classical, which
it
has Roman roots.
And again, if you're looking at it from a cinematic kind of history point of view, the same exact thing was done in the Gladiator movie, where Rome was absolutely given the fascist aesthetic treatment. The scene where you first see Rome itself and Commodus's return, I mean, it's pure Leni Riefenstahl, right?
Yeah, it's very like Triumph of the
World.
Yeah,
absolutely. The whole desaturation and the banners. You see all of that repeated in The Hunger Games. They're both talking about not Berlin, mm-hmm. whilst very much talking about Berlin. And the arena in Hunger Games, the film that we're talking about, is visually a mashup of two stadiums. So there's the Centennial Hall, I think it's called, in Poland, which was, I think, built just before the First World War. That's the interior and a little bit of the exterior. But most of the exterior is the Olympic Stadium from 1936 Olympics in Berlin. So they're very much wanting us to think about World War II, very much so, but in a way that also kind of, you still get that kind of thing of, this kind of reminds me of ancient Rome because I've seen ancient Rome through Ridley Scott's fascist lens.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, because we can't talk about anything without talking about World War II. I mean, they bring in the tributes on castle cars.
Yeah.
I mean, that wasn't subtle, was it? And that was that was the opposite of subtle.
And I think that's like why it was easy for me to make connections to like things I'm saying from the Trojan War playing out. Like I could also view Coriolis as an Achilles figure, right? Mm-hmm. Very much so. I'm not supposed to root for Achilles. He kind of sucks, but he's also like, this entire Iliad is about him. So like, am I not supposed to assume that I'm supposed to relate to him on some level? I
guess this brings us to our initial kind of like the initial thing, the gripe that we kind of glossed over, but I think is worth revisiting, which is, should this prequel exist, right? Because we have lots of prequels now, and every time there's a new, I mean, even I just saw the Wonka. We were talking about that before we started recording. And like, did we need to have the Wonka origin story? Do we need the X origin story? Somebody made a joke about, I think there was a Disney movie that's like, did you ever wonder the origins of the wishing star? I'm like, no, I didn't. I never wondered. And Snow is exactly that, where it's like, did we need to humanize future Hitler?
Yeah.
Was that the goal though? Like, I never liked him.
Is it to understand him, I guess.
And that's kind of an interesting question that I pose to my own students. You know, so when looking at the Rwandan genocide, the author I have them read from is a journalist who went and talked to both Tutsi survivors, but also Hutu perpetrators in one of the prisons from the same neighborhood. And he talks about like how he really struggled with the fact, like, do I give voice to the perpetrators to have them explain their reasoning? Like, do I want to platform that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the question is like, he decides ultimately, yes, you know, he's going to try and make sure he contextualizes their rhetoric for a general audience. But it's like, most of my students are like, yeah, at the end of the day, it's like, we do need to understand where these people came from, how they came to make those decisions, if we want any chance of recognizing it and preventing it again in the future. So I think these stories can be important in that regard. Now, does it need to be this specific story? I don't know. Would I rather have a Choreo story or a Hitler biopic?
You know, I mean, thinking about it, especially since what is happening in the world right now, I mean, we're talking about a film that's discussing, can you justify violence? How do you justify violence? And what kind of person do you need to be to justify violence, especially if it's aimed at a group such as children? And, you know, with current world events, you're seeing on social media people making the point of, you guys watched and read the Hunger Games trilogy, and yet in the real world, you don't appear to be siding with the districts and the rebels anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe it is a good time to have a film that does really push the question of, is it ever right to oppress a group of people, to dehumanize them, to other them, to kill their children? And can you still be a good guy, or are you always going to be seen as the bad guy? Because at the moment, the world seems to be really confused on this matter. So maybe, yeah, we do need something in Hollywood to just prod our thinking again of, oh, wow, okay, this isn't just a dystopian novel anymore. This does have real world parallels.
Well, I think also about the system, right? Like the government, like that we are cogs in a bigger machine. And I can sort of see how a very generous viewing of Coriolanus the Snow's story would be that he is like a cog in the system, and that like Dr. Gall pushes her worldview on him in that whole question, what are the games for? And he, within this really horrific system that is perpetuating violence, just as he is also perpetuating violence, makes him make like the worst decisions he could and still get ahead. So is it like the system itself that is propping up these terrible, terrible choices that are still like having people succeed? And I think that is something we do very much see today, is that our system perpetuates a lot of things, and the worst types of people often get ahead.
Yeah.
And so maybe in the most generous viewing of this, it's like a big red flag.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what they have a saying, didn't they? What was it? The quote was, snow always lands on top.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of snow puns generally, but yes, the snow falls, snow lands on top. Something, a lot of things about the sort of purity of snow, or, you know, not getting your hands dirty. I think there was a lot of those kinds of metaphors being
well, and there was the last thing I picked up on too, and it's like how you could have reaction to a mass trauma event is like you can take accountability for what you did, but still be sympathetic to the reasons of why you might have done that. So Lucy Gray saying, I'm a killer, we're both killers. And Corio always saying, well, I'm a survivor. But at the end, he says, I'm a victor. And I think that's the shift of where you turn into, you know, not someone who did something that because they needed to for survival. And, you know, or if you tried to be, you know, you try to refuse accountability, it's like, it's not what I did to survive, it's what I did to win. And that has very different connotations for us.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For we can say anything like as we're going out, I feel like we're sort of getting toward the end of our hour maybe. But before we do, just after our last remarks, I want to read you guys my favorite review of this movie.
Okay.
So that can be last. So if there's anything else.
Is it a funny review?
Yeah, it is. It's like we're very serious, and like there's a lot of heavy, heavy topics.
Well, yeah, I guess we got to find a way to we got to segue out of this.
I got one. What was your favorite song from the movie? Because I actually really enjoyed the music in this film.
I need to remind myself of all
the
hanging songs.
Tree. You have the one
The one that they're in like the club and she's singing it like with the band.
That's a reprisal of the
You
of
Can't
the
Take Away From
TV,
Me.
Yeah. Right?
You can't take my voice from me. Yeah. There is the one the there before she sings as the snakes are coming after her.
Yeah, that's
There's
a good one.
The one she sings about her ex while Coriolis is in the hospital. I think those are the main ones.
I really like the eulogy song that she kind of wrote for herself for her interview.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was a cool one.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting.
Yeah, that's basically like her calling out her ex and the mayor's daughter for like sending her to the Hunger Games, basically.
I think I liked that one.
It's a good one.
I liked the There Before one, like when the snakes are coming for her. I liked that one a lot too, of just supposedly her final moments, and like her instinct is to sing, and it's like, you know, what regrets or what things does she hope to like convey in those last few moments, I thought was.
And again, I mean, music has always been a huge cultural trauma response. If you think about the song The Hanging Tree, has a really obvious parallel, for instance, in Strange Fruit.
Sure.
Yeah.
So again, it's working through your emotions about your own oppression and
that's what
the possibility of resistance.
Are we leading to, this is the thesis of like, how does society respond to mass trauma? And it's
badly.
Either song or forced combat.
You can either sing or you can make kids kill each other. It's your choice. I'll leave it up to you.
Well, and that's what Homer, that's what the Iliad is, right? It is a song about mass trauma. So I think we've always had both reactions, right? Kill everyone so that they can't turn around and do it to you in the future, then sing about it.
Oh, I dread to think what songs are going to be coming out in the next couple of years.
I will say Olivia Rodrigo. I also really liked Olivia Rodrigo's song that rolled the credits for this. Because
yeah, that was really beautiful.
That to me was also a very Eurydice kind of song overall. Mm-hmm. Like, and I like he gets bit by a snake in the forest, right?
Yeah, we glossed over all the
I know. Imagery. I know. And we're going to talk about snakes next week or this week, Colin. But so fun fact, one of my favorite YouTube channels is called Snake Discovery. And it's a woman my age who's just so obsessed with snakes to the point like she does snake hatching videos. And she's like, oh, look how cute they are. They're so sassy. They're trying to bite me. And I'm like, I love you so much. But like, I can see most of those snakes. And it's like, you know, he freaks out because he assumes they're venomous. But like, I know at least one's a corn snake that they show. That's that bright orange one.
Yeah. I was doing, I don't know. Well, so Alexander, I don't know if you have the same memory, but many children in the United States, we learn a rhyme for because we have two kinds of snakes, coral snakes and milk snakes. And they look very similar. They're red with kind of black and white and yellow stripes along their bodies. And you learn like a rhyme to be able to, and one of them, the milk snakes are totally harmless and they're fine and you just let them be. But coral snakes are very dangerous, or they can be. And so you learn a rhyme to differentiate between the two different snakes. And I found myself in one scene, she was holding the snake. And I was like, okay, red touches yellow, you're a dead fellow. Red touches black, you're okay, Jack. I did
the same exact thing.
I'm not even sure Britain has any dangerous snakes.
I don't
think we have. Cute little things that kind of curl up under logs. We're fine.
I have now learned that my favorites are hognose snakes who have like little noses that like turn up. They're so cute.
So cute.
And ball pythons because they just curl up in little balls and they're very pretty. So
I'm thinking now also there's another thing about water snakes and water moccasins. One's nominally fine, one's pretty venomous, and you want to stay clear, but they have this tendency if you're ever in the southeast in like the bayous or the swamps and you're in the boat, they will like fall out of the trees just into your boat.
Yeah.
But
it's great.
Anyway,
we don't really have anything like that. I don't think there's any animal that we have a rhyme for. We've just managed to eradicate every single one, I guess.
I lost the thread on, we were talking about snakes, but Eli, do you want to, you had a review you wanted to share with us.
I have three actually, because they're just all very funny. And they make me laugh. So my runner up is never trust a man in his buzz cut era. Hunger Games, the musical episode, which like, yeah, kind of. But my favorite, my very favorite is men have one bad breakup in high school and make it everyone's problem for the rest of their life.
Yep.
Ain't that the truth?
Nope. I like also the video I sent you guys about like the Hunger Games pitch, and it's like
that like summed up the movie really well.
So well. I also just says like, and he's sent to Eminem Purgatory, and I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so true.
I mean, one thing that there was a lot more movie. There's a point in the movie at about like, oh, there's like an hour left of this, and like we're still going. Like I thought the movie was about to end after she wins the games, but like there was a lot more. This movie felt like two movies, which is ironic because the third book they turned into two,
which no one liked either. So there's no winning that one.
Well, that was part of a whole trend, right? Because I think Harry Potter was the one.
And then
it was Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings did it first.
No. Right? Harry Potter came out before.
No.
The Hobbit. But the Lord of the Rings didn't.
Okay. The Hobbit did.
Yeah, The Hobbit they split into three movies, but that's a whole other thing. Whole other bag of snakes. No.
It was Harry Potter, Twilight. Yeah, and then Hunger Games. Yeah.
And then I think they stopped because I think people started revolting about it.
2010s were a weird time.
Yeah,
people are going to have to start writing novels with like a midpoint just in case someone wants to adapt it now. Because, you know, who wants to make one movie when you could make seven and really make people sick of him?
There's maybe an argument that the last Harry Potter book sort of warranted it because there was a lot that happened in that last book. But yeah. The Hunger Games and Twilight, I feel like, don't warrant. Because then you just end up with half a story. I mean, I think I've seen I think I've seen the first Hunger Games movie a few times, but I think I've only seen the sequels once each. And I would be very hard pressed to tell you what happens in Mockingjay Part 1.
Yeah.
I really couldn't tell you what happens.
I think that's when they go reading balls to the wall propaganda.
Yeah.
But apart from that, I forget.
And they get nuked. They're like in a bomb shelter for like half the book. And then like they get nuked at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they could have kept that as one film, but this one didn't need to be a film at all. So,
so there we go.
I was just like, you guys think of all of the books that came out about the end of the world, and we got COVID, and then I'm kind of really waiting to see what happens after that.
Oh, Jesus.
So, I mean, I was like trying to think of like what would be like a fun and easy question for us to end on, but in light of the whole discussion about genocide we just had, what would your strategy be in the Hunger Games? What district would you be from? But that all feels in very poor
what
taste.
What kind
right
of
now.
Critter do you want Gaul to create?
like as an evil critter or as like a fun
of
critter?
Anything yeah. you want? Like
you are a mad yeah. scientist with unlimited resources at your disposal. What crime against nature do you make?
Okay. Dinosaurs?
You're like, can we have Jurassic Park?
I'm getting a call. It's to Steven Spielberg. Can you send back off?
What I really want is a Triceratops with a Stegosaurus like mashed up, because I always thought to myself when I was a kid that those two would be best friends because one's got a horned face and one's got a horned butt.
I love it.
And then I worked out that no one's Jurassic and one's Cretaceous and they never met each other and got to be best friends. So I'm very depressed. So I want to mash up with one of those, please. Yeah. Horns just everywhere. Mm-hmm. I mean, there has been a dinosaur in an arena movie, but that was the Playmobil movie, so I don't think it counts. But, you know, I'd love to see a gladiator go up against a dinosaur. That's the movie that I really want. Someone make that one for me. I can talk about that for hours.
Ridley Scott. Let's go.
No, not Ridley Scott. No, please. No. Have mercy on me. No more Ridley Scott gladiators movies.
I want something with a red panda.
Cute. But is it going to kill me?
I know, that's what I'm trying to figure out. It's like, what would it do? Can it,
would it be poisonous?
Maybe like no. No. What it can do is similar to like magpies. It can find important things that you need to survive aww. In the war. So like maybe, or maybe it's trained like a pig to like sniff out truffles or something.
I'm not sure you're cruel enough to run the Hunger Games.
The Mockingjay thing was, it was for intel, right? So it just has to serve a functional purpose in war. It doesn't have to be cruel per se.
It's a little bit riffing off the Mockingjay, but I got one, which is a raccoon that is compulsively painting and has a photographic memory. So it just, when you put like a canvas in front of it, it will just paint whatever it's seen, and you can use it to, and it could basically be like a courtroom sketch artist, or you could use it to gather intel where you
so
have all these
scout,
raccoons
basically.
Out there, and then they come back and then they finger paint whatever intelligence they've gathered.
Picturing
from the
little
enemy.
Raccoons with their little raccoon hands, like painting in a courtroom.
Yeah.
Love it.
Or a snake whose venom compels you to tell the truth.
Yeah, that seems like it would fall right in line. Is it weird that like one of my first thoughts after dinosaur was like the, you know, the dog spider costumes where they put the spider legs on the dog? That's what I
wanted. Good lord. A fluffy dog spider.
So I am not going to sleep tonight. Thank you very much.
You want an Aragog, basically.
I
that
do.
Won't teach you.
No.
Or spiders that can be programmed to spin messages into their
eyes.
No. So
you
can
send
messages.
It can make you a hammock. Yes. Nailed it. I want a spider that will spin me tree hammocks to sleep in.
You could have like a kangaroo and it could have like your sponsor items in its pouch. And there then it can just give you hugs when you're cold.
Aww,
I don't know. I'm definitely not.
Kangaroos are that nice.
No, I've seen a couple of videos of like some really muscular ones punching the shit out of stuff. Yeah. I think that's everything in Australia, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Pretty much. All right. I guess that's probably a sign that we should end the day.
Yeah.
We end on kangaroos.
I know. I love it.
No, that's it. You get the last word. Listeners, thank you again for listening. If you enjoy, you can find us on moviesweedig.com. Listen to us on most major streaming services, as well as on Blue Sky and Ko-fi. And we're on Instagram now. And am I forgetting any others, Christy?
Oh, we're all over the place.
So follow us on social media. Please sort of rate and review. That really helps us a lot. Alexandra, thank you again so much for being on the show. We hope you had a good time with us.
As always, yeah, of course I did. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right, and we'll have you back before too long to talk more about
Spartacus, apparently. Yeah.
Yeah, Farticus. Anyway, so on that note, we will say goodbye. Have a good night, everyone. Take it easy. Bye.
Bye.